And thanks for coming to this session. People probably feel pretty sick of thinking about and maybe talking about the pandemic, but it's not going anywhere. So we have to keep thinking about it and talking about it. And it's raised a lot of it's taken us into a whole new sort of political world in a way, and there's been so much to grapple with. In a way, old questions raised in new ways, but in some ways, new kind of dividing lines. And I think one of the things that hopefully come out of this talk is a bit of an assessment of how the left has responded to this major challenge. And I think some pretty major failings when it comes to the collective left response to the issues raised by the pandemic. So I'm sure people are well aware we're 18 months to nearly 2 years since the virus was first picked up, and the official estimates of what between 4 and 5 million people have so far died as a result of the virus. But the Economist's study of excess deaths in the period of the pandemic puts the estimate at more like 15 million. And the devastation is pretty obvious every night on the news, not just the deaths, but the people suffering who are ill, the overloading of health systems one after the other around the world, the enormous stress and trauma put on the people who work in the health sector, who have to care for these people and watch this terrible situation unfold. And, of course, pandemics aren't anything new. Pandemics have shaped so many aspects of modern society. Like even the town planning in Australia has been heavily influenced by the tuberculosis epidemic at the start of last century that, saw the end of terrace houses, saw the introduction of nature strips, wider streets and roads, space around houses. The other infectious disease pandemics in Europe created the basis of basic hygiene control and have influenced all sorts of aspects of life that you wouldn't necessarily think about. In a way, modern capitalism should be uniquely placed to respond most efficiently and most humanely to a pandemic. It has strict, very well-administered borders. It has instant communication. It has, a huge pharmaceutical industry, health systems in most countries, and yet we know the terrible toll it's taken and the almost universal reluctance of governments and authorities to respond in a manner befitting the crisis and in a manner that puts human life ahead of considerations of the economy and maintaining business as usual. And the most common pattern that it's followed in most countries has been that governments have been reluctant to act, unwilling to act, too slow to act, and the virus has got into various populations and, been fairly quickly unable to be controlled. Or when I say unable, there being no political will to control it and it being sufficiently infectious that it could wreak quite a lot of devastation in a relatively short time. And having, not admitted the problem at the outset, most of the world's governments now, this isn't on us. This is a biological phenomenon that we couldn't control. And the main responsibility of governments now is looking at the question of how do we get back to normal? And I think the whole idea that we've got to get back to normal is part of the problem with the response to the virus. It's something that, modern politicians who administer a huge amount of public money who are meant to be there concerned at least to some degree about public good see this as a huge inconvenience and annoying incursion on what their real job is, which is giving out contracts to their friends, running the state as a business, kicking people off welfare, like all the punitive things that's come to characterise what modern politics is about. And, you can see just a lot of them are stunned. I mean, Brett Ratton in New South Wales really sums it up best for me. Like, he can't believe he has to front up the media every day to talk about people's collective health. He's like, this is not why I got into politics. I got into politics to get another house in Portsea and give out, contracts to my friends and get a good cushy corporate job at the end of it. The idea that now public health has got to be this main focus of government, you can see it's just such anathema to the sensibility and the culture of politics. That's not what they see themselves as being there for. So the idea that we're all trying to get back to this great normal where everyone could just make money and you could go to Bunnings at any hour of the day and that was the nirvana that we're trying to get back to is really wrong. Like, this pandemic has got, well, it should have already dramatically reshaped society in such a way as to protect people from this disease, and indeed future pandemics that are also, you know, bound to happen. This has hardly come out of nowhere. But that's been the pattern in most countries, with some honourable exceptions. And in some cases, the reverse kind of logic has played out. So I think in China, the prestige of the Chinese state has been linked to how well they can repress the virus. And, you know, that's part of the way the China-US rivalry has played out, that China is showing this great, capableness by keeping the virus out, even eliminating, I mean, if we can believe their statistics, and I think it would be hard to misrepresent the situation to the degree you would need to make it seem as though the Chinese state has eradicated the Delta strain as well. Well, meanwhile, supposedly the world's preeminent superpower is having, you know, hospital wards overrun, has, you know, whatever, huge, 1 in 500 people died, and it's shown itself absolutely incapable of containing this threat, whereas the Chinese government has, you know, been at pains at pains to show its, demonstrate its control over the situation. Australia has been a bit different, but I think it's worth talking about Australia in this item, because the way it's played out here has been, or had its own unique, I guess, peculiarities that have been more political than a lot of Australia's involvement in world crises in the past, which is often that Australia's fairly removed from them. So Australia wasn't like China in the sense that from the outset it was consciously wanted to be a country that maintained elimination. Partly it was a matter of chance and accidental good management that meant the virus was contained. So closing the borders and preventing anyone that might be infected from coming in, and then locking down relatively quickly to contain it. And that was obviously motivated at first by a fear, how deadly, how debilitating, how catching the virus was at first. It wasn't clear. And, you know, a crisis-averse government took, some action to avert the crisis. But pretty soon when they realised, or saw the way it was playing out in other countries, I think, you know, the Morrison government in particular wished that Australia had gone down that path. But once they established it was possible to keep COVID out of the country, they had developed an expectation, quite rightly, amongst people, that it should be kept out of the country, and the people had a right to be protected from this this virus, even if it wasn't quite as deadly to pass the government's test of whether or not it should be kept out. No one wanted to die, surprisingly enough, from the virus. And, once the eradication had been shown to be possible, there was an expectation, a demand, really, that it that situation be maintained. And the overwhelming victory of the McGowan government in WA that had demonstrated an ability to keep the virus out reinforced that. There was also a real domestic expediency for the politicians in being able to keep COVID out of the country, or the state, or whatever jurisdiction we're talking about. So in a way that was accidental, but in the course of doing that, they showed their hand, if you like, a bit. They showed that this was possible, and they showed that with the right measures, almost all measures that completely go against the neoliberal mindset of how states should be run, the virus could be contained. So closing the borders, which, of course, the Australian government did not particularly want to do. This was not good for Qantas. It's not good for the travel industry and the tourism industry that the Australian economy is dependent on, especially, you know, obviously first it was mainly towards China, where, you know, the bulk of international students come from, that they're one of Australia's most important trading partners. There was no actual desire to close the borders to China, but the government did it in recognition of the fact that that's where the virus was coming from. Then the lockdowns as well, obviously governments didn't want to do that, but they showed that, you know, all that was effective. The other thing they did that was completely contrary to the neoliberal mindset was provide financial backing for people in order to enable them to comply with health orders. So doubling Newstart and, you know, JobKeeper, for all the problems with JobKeeper and for all the sense in which it was really a handout to business, nevertheless, making it clear that the government was prepared to spend basically anything to ensure that people were not financially disadvantaged by observing health orders made an enormous difference to the way in which the first lockdown was observed and its effectiveness. The people felt a sense of investment in stopping the virus and that they were going to be, you know, supported through that. And the government revealed that actually there is no economic or financial barrier to massive increases in welfare, to massive increases in measures to lift workers' living standards and ensure financial security for workers. All the, like, literally overnight, all the contentions that underpin, you know, budget after budget of Labor and Liberal governments was just blown out of the water. Suddenly there was billions of dollars. The government could go into tons of debt in order to ensure that people complied with lockdown. And this is when they're in the stage of being frightened. They're now obviously trying to erase all that from people's memory and live that down. They never want to go back there. And they've done a complete about face. So they saw, you know, they sat and waited, then they saw, well, yeah, there's deaths, there's, you know, a real strain on the health system, there's a lot of suffering, there's probably this long COVID thing, but all that is manageable. We can still have Bunnings open, we can still have, you know, people going snorkeling on the Great Barrier Reef with that situation, and that is what we've got to get back to. So we have to wipe out the idea that people are entitled to be protected from COVID. We want to use the mass vaccination as an excuse to make it seem like this isn't some march towards, you know, certain death for people. But we've got to get back. We've got to bludgeon people into accepting that this is the new normal. This is the new reality. But people saw that what was possible if, you know, when governments did, even for a brief period, did have the genuine objective of trying to contain the disease. And so that situation has set up a situation where the evolving response to COVID, the attempt by the officialdom to get us to accept, you know, living with COVID, has taken on a real class dynamic in a way that hasn't been the case in every country in the world. And so on one side you have Scott Morrison, the kind of reluctant, you know, we wish we never did, but, you know, we're in this position now and we've got to try and, you know, without too much compromising our electoral, you know, with an eye to the upcoming federal election, without stuffing up their advantage too much, but to get people, for the sake of business, for the sake of the economy, to accept living with COVID, headed up by him and, you know, both under pressure from him or in cahoots with him, most of the corporate world. So the open letter backing the opening up plan that came out of the National Cabinet that was in, you know, most major newspapers, signed by 80-plus major corporations, it's kind of the obvious example of it. But, you know, this coalition went right back. Even in the first lockdown in Victoria, you know, there was a bosses group, informal coalition of bosses with the not only bosses, also the Victorian branch of the CFMEU, and John Secker was part of it as well, who were against the lockdown, who are champions of, you know, business, and we can't, you know, when somebody think of the businesses sort of a mentality that lobbied the Victorian government, that actually on the eve of the Victorian government lifting the lockdown, organisation of Melbourne's largest restaurant owners were preparing to openly defy the lockdown and open their restaurants as a fuck you to the government. And, you know, a lot of the attention a lot of the anti-lockdown sentiment is focused on the kind of the fringe kind of right-wing people that protest in the street that are, you know, defiant of authority and all that. And they are a visible and they're an important force to contend with and for us to understand. But the real power and where the real push for opening up and against these measures came from is from, you know, the big end of town that don't need to take to the streets, but that work in cahoots with the politicians to you know, dream up whatever arguments they need to push their economic economic agenda. And, you know, the most recently and perhaps the most laughable one they've come up with is the one about, you know, their concern for our mental health, and that's why, you know, they're opening up, which, you know, like pretty much every policy the Liberal government's ever enacted has been bad for our collective mental health, but that's, you know, never bothered them before now. And so you have, you know, that them on one side and the, you know, the state Liberal, not all the state Liberal premiers, but the New South Wales government as well. So organisation, the bosses, the lunatic fringe right, early on the Murdoch press, but the Murdoch press is, I mean, the Murdoch press has had a consistent line about opening up, but sort of for different reasons at different times. And then, the business council and the official bosses. And then on the other side, you've had the Labor premiers who, you know, I think mainly for electoral reasons have seen the benefit in just doing whatever needs to be done to contain the virus, partly because they've shown, you know, it's possible. And the first Victorian lockdown, you know, difficult though it was, it had all the federal government measures to back it up, and it was successful in a reasonably short period of time. So I think the other premiers thought, you know, this is the road to go down. So you have them, you have the most of the union movement, you have the, you know, health workers that are most affected by this, teachers who are going to, you know, are at some of the riskiest, the front line of where, you know, mass infection sites. You have also mass opinion, indicated in opinion poll after opinion poll that, you know, people had far better attitudes than the business community and the Liberal governments about, you know, deaths. You know, there should not be any deaths. There should be the proper measures taken to prevent that. And where it was made easy for people, a very high level of compliance with the health orders, and a clear sense that people took it seriously, and where they could, they complied as well as possible. Vast majority of people in that category. And also just something that's a bit harder, a bit less tangible, is just the sense of social solidarity that came out of that, that, you know, we have this collective goal. We're trying to stop people getting sick and die. We're mindful that every interaction we have could, you know, potentially down a chain of contagion affect someone's grandmother, or, you know, this sense of we're all looking out for each other and we're trying to do what's best for our, you know, the public good, which is not a sentiment that tends to be encouraged in capitalist society for obvious reasons. And it was that sense of, you know, we're doing this together for a higher purpose, that, you know, the Liberal government, the Morrison government, is now really doing, got its work cut out for it, trying to bludgeon out of people. And it's very heartening to see that they're only having limited success in that regard. So in this equation, where has the left stood? I think, you know, internationally, it's a bit of a different thing. Countries where the virus just took off and got out of control fairly quickly, the issues are obviously very different to some places where containment has been shown to be possible. But I think, I mean, overall, something that can be said in general about the left, and there are honourable exceptions to this, definitely, but compared to issues like, you know, the crisis created by September 11 and the war on terror and, you know, big world crises, the world economic crisis in 2008, where the left could immediately recognise this is a massive issue that's going to start shaping and colouring pretty much every aspect of the way international capitalism functions for, you know, who knows how long, potentially, you know, irreversibly. You wouldn't pick that up from looking at the way the international left has responded to this issue. And I think it's because, and certainly not the way the left has responded in Australia. And I think part of that is because the ways in which the issues that have been raised are not ones that the left is used to dealing with. For one thing, it's a massive exercise of state power and the state trying to, you know, influence people's behaviour, bringing in extreme like restrictions that are absolutely, you know, when you know, at the time seemed shocking and very difficult to adapt to. And the left is used to opposing, you know, the authoritarian nature of the state, because you know, in the era of neoliberalism, the state has been, you know, the state has been authoritarian and repressive, and that's partly because in the era of neoliberalism, the state has been about criminalizing, you know, the policies of neoliberalism create an enormous amount of poverty, and rather than trying to solve any of those problems, the state has criminalized people in poverty. So all the, filling up jails with people who are in jail for crimes of poverty, making everything more oppressive, more punitive towards people, whether through the welfare system or whatever it is, that's been the modus operandi of the state. And it's been very difficult to adjust to, well, the state's, exercising this huge amount of power over us, but in this case, it's not about enforcing a more unequal world. It's not about, creating an environment that's most conducive to big business making the most amount of money. In this particular instance, sort of through accident a lot of the time in Australia, the states are acting in such a way as to try and protect people's lives and protect people being infected with the disease. And so that doesn't mean we cheer on absolutely everything the state does, but our approach to it, the critical way in which we approach the state in this situation is it doing enough, and is what it's doing effective to prevent mass infection of with a deadly virus? Not the state's doing anything repressive, therefore we oppose it because that's what the left does. To assume that and to not recognise that that means you're lining up with the most reactionary forces in society, with business, who oppose the state on the basis of we won't stand by while public health is prioritised over our profits and our, business as usual. For the left not to be able to recognise that that's the forces that they're giving salve to, or giving a progressive sort of angle into that basic push, is pretty inexcusable in my opinion. So you just think back to the beginning. The one of the first things the Australian government did, and probably the most effective, was closing the borders. And this has been something that, obviously it's in our statement of principles, where for socialist alternative is for open borders. Campaigning against the punitive ways in which borders are enforced has been a signature issue of the left. But in this case, it was the borders actually had some value to offer with infection control. And this is not bosses trying to scapegoat any particular group for a political purpose. This was contrary actually to the economic interests of the bosses, if they want, and of the government. If they want to drum up racism towards any group, they'll generally do it in a way that doesn't cost them money. So, they love drumming up hostility to refugees, for instance. But the entire time they've drummed up hostility to refugees and gone on about borders and all that, not the entire time, but over that period, on average, the amount of immigration into Australia has increased. In a way, pointing the finger at refugees was about distracting people from the reality that immigration was essential to the Australian economy and was being, being increased. So they want racism because it serves them, their purposes politically, but they don't actually want to stop people coming to Australia. So they are quite adept at finding a way to combine those two things. They do not want to stop people coming to Australia from China. People, on average, that come to Australia from China do so to spend a lot of money, and that is not what the government was aiming to do. But most of the left failed to recognise that. Then, but I think the left should support that. But then we should also be for the government putting in measures that enable international travel to resume, and prioritising compassionate travel and travel related to better controlling the pandemic. In order to do that, what needed to happen was that for there to be safe quarantine facilities so that when people did travel, they weren't risking taking the disease with them. And so that needed to happen right from the beginning. The fact that, even under Labor governments, this was treated as, here's a, lucrative a function that some private company can come in and fill, was one of the reasons why the disease was able to escape from hotel quarantine. So actually the demand that purpose-built safe facilities well away from populations be built was an important safety demand, and it was an important demand to enable people to start moving around the world to see dying loved ones and whatever it might be that everyone agrees, you know, no one wants to prevent. But you know, how has a lot of the left reacted to this? This is building prison camps in the desert. You know, the left should be against prison camps in the desert. This is just, you know, because people, it has the appearance of, yeah, camps where people are crossing borders go to, has the appearance of, you know, things that we've opposed in the past. There's a failure to recognise the actual content of what's going on here is not punitive scapegoating of the people concerned. It was a necessary policy to protect the health and well-being of the mass of people. And, you know, there's a sort of another contradiction there, that just the use of state resources, you know, because at one stage people were angry that maybe this old military camp and the Howard Springs facility would be used. But in fact, it's bread and butter of the left to demand state resources be used to help people. During the bushfires at the start of 2020, when people were stranded in Mallacoota, there was a demand that the Australian government shouldn't just stand by and do nothing while people are threatened by, you know, raging inferno, that actually they should send the Navy to help people. They've got these massive resources at their disposal, but they're like, no, we will only use these to go to war and kill people. We will not use it to rescue people from a fire that we're responsible for. Actually, it's right for the left to demand that the government should take responsibility for rescuing people and preventing them being killed by a fire or harmed. And, you know, likewise, the workers' movement historically has demanded things like purpose-built quarantine facilities. You know, waterside workers and seafarers have demanded that in the past because of the work that they do, the risk posed by people that move around the world spreading infectious disease. So this is not an anathema to the left. It jars a bit with what we're used to in the era of neoliberalism, but that's partly because, you know, people, you know, traditions can quickly be forgotten. So the other, I guess, big point of contention that the left, by and large in Australia, haven't really taken the right side on has been the question of lockdowns and enforcement of lockdowns. And, you know, I think the issue of enforcement is one, I think we have to say, if we support the measures, we have to support their, I don't know why the cat is not agreeing with this, but if we support the measures, we have to support the enforcement. It's like, you know, the analogy I think that works to think about is drink driving. Driving drunk is an extremely antisocial thing to do, and people shouldn't be allowed to do it. People should, you know, people should pressure other people not to do it. But we can't say that, but then also oppose the police setting up booze buses. We don't champion booze buses, but you can hardly say that, you know, otherwise the law's a dead letter. Otherwise you are allowed to drive drunk. So demands that, you know, that the state, you know, things that the state does for the public good, if they weren't being enforced and instead the resources of the state are being put towards, you know, rounding up people, you know, accusing people of welfare fraud or whatever other ends the state might put its resources towards, that would be a criticism of the state. So I think, you know, we have to accept that enforcement is about establishing with people that this is serious and this has to be followed. But on the other hand, we object when the police's inherent, you know, social bias comes out and they, you know, send all the patrols to some area and not another. But then also we've got to be a little bit careful about that as well. Like the criticism of Daniel Andrews' first lockdown, where he locked down the North Melbourne Flemington Towers without much notice, where there's a lot of very large African population, you know, there should have been more notice. On the other hand, we would criticise them for not taking special measures that affect particularly vulnerable populations. And, you know, the lockdowns and enforcement of lockdowns and other health measures, they, you know, if they fail, the people who are affected most are you know, the poorest people, people who live in the most densely, crowded environments. One of the arguments against lockdown is, women bear the brunt of it. But it's going to be women that bear the brunt of people being sick with coronavirus, caring for elderly people, caring for people with long COVID. So that argument can go either way. Actually, resources should be put towards ensuring that health directives are followed in the communities that are going to bear the worst brunt if coronavirus gets out of control. So I think we have to think about it through that lens, not just kind of the knee-jerk reaction that most people, that a lot of people on the left have had, which is, you know, the police are doing this, like that's in and of itself reactionary and has got to be opposed. There's been a whole debate about the lockdowns. The left has echoed a lot of what the bosses have said, basically, about mental health. There's been the idea it's ableist, it's sexist, it's racist. But, I just think, for the reason I just said, that's wrong. And I think, it's kind of summed up most succinctly by that Patty Gibson, who's a supposedly a socialist and fairly high-profile Indigenous rights activist in Sydney, who once it became clear that coronavirus was probably going to start circulating without, uncontrollably in Australia, thought it was the appropriate moment to tweet that RIP COVID zero dream in Australia, you're always a figment of the nationalist fortress Australia imagination anyway. I hope it's him who is fronting up to the Wilcannia and other Aboriginal communities that COVID is now arriving at and making those people understand that they are dying not from government inaction on COVID and government ineptness and commitment to business over people's lives, but they're actually dying for the internationalist, for the socialist principle of internationalism. I'm sure that will warm people's hearts when they're suffering from COVID. And I think that's not exactly a ringing or a very good advertisement for socialist politics, that we're for people dying, because if people weren't dying here, it would be nationalist because people are dying elsewhere, which is basically what this position boils down to, and that we should be hostile to governments taking the necessary measures to stop people, to stop COVID getting out of control, and that we're very possible and we're proved to be very effective. Actually, it's a better situation now that the government's pro-business agenda has prevailed and now people are at much higher risk of getting COVID and dying. That's the scenario. That's the worldview that the left was championing or should have championed. And now it's great. We've got our way, and we can raise a glass with the Business Council of Australia in our success on that front. I think it's been really important. In a way, these questions are nothing new, but they are quite a new style or new kind of flavour to politics that the pandemic has posed, that the role of the state is quite different from what's gone before. Everyone's had to overnight become a kind of armchair epidemiologist, that there's been a rift opened up amongst, health experts, science has become politicised, and it goes down to like every little aspect of how society is run. Like, why is it like, does it have to be like that? Is that safe? How could we change it? And when it's not changed, why not? What are the powerful interests that are trying to just keep their head in the sand, maintain business as usual, because the system works very well for us as it is right now. And, it doesn't particularly matter to us that, few people suffer and die from a disease, so long as, we can plough on as normal. So I think it's been really important for the left to be the ones championing that the government should be doing more, and pointing out their where they've failed or been inadequate, but always with our concern in this situation is preventing people getting this disease, and that the massive resources of modern capitalism should be able to do that and should be put towards that end.